Industries Board, to the Farm Loan Board, to the Federal Reserve Board. By the mid-1920s, he had helped revive American agriculture through his work on the War Finance Corporation, which had special authorization to make loans for the benefit of farmers and livestock growers. He liquidated the corporation early in 1925 in an achievement that was widely recognized as remarkable. As Merlo Pusey described it in his biography of my father, Meyer had handed the Treasury a check for $499 million. It was ultimately sent to the National Archives in the belief that it was the largest check ever drawn in the history of the world. The WFC had lent $700 million, $300 for war purposes, $100 to finance post-war exports, $300 to aid farmers, without loss and with enough return to pay interest on the bonds it had issued and the funds obtained from the Treasury. Many were saying he had saved American agriculture from disaster. During my childhood, when my father was busy with his series of government jobs, my parents were mostly absent. When they were home, there were formal moments when we would see them. My mother always had her breakfast in bed, and my father usually had his in her bedroom, on a small table beside her. We went upstairs to see them for a little while before we went our separate ways. Mother sometimes took one of us for a drive in the park in the afternoon, or had us in for a talk in her bedroom. But these occasions were few and far between, and more often than not, the exchanges were one way. Nonetheless, I loved these times, and once commented that since she was so busy, perhaps we should make appointments to meet, a story she used to repeat as quaint. My parents went out to dinner most evenings, or entertained elaborately at home. Sometimes I visited with mother as she dressed, or when she was being massaged or manicured. My mother impressed me as being incredibly glamorous, regal, and beautiful, and I was secretly proud when she appeared at school functions elegantly dressed. But though I was deeply fond of her when I was very young, I was awed by and terrified of her at the same time. With the rarest exceptions, I was much too scared ever to consider disobeying. On the few occasions I did, the results made a lasting impression. On my first trip to Europe when I was 11, Mother told Bill and me to go to the ship's barber to get our hair cut. We had another plan. Bill told me to tell her there was a line waiting, and that we would go later, and I mindlessly carried out his order, something I tended to do too much throughout my life. Mother somehow found out there wasn't any line at the barber's and severely reprimanded me for lying, which I wasn't even aware I was doing, and put me alone in my cabin. I was crushed, but the episode made an indelible impression on me about the importance of telling the truth. A few years later, as a freshman in high school, I transgressed again on the coiffure front. I cut my long, curly black hair against my mother's will. I awaited her reaction with fear and trepidation, and was puzzled and a bit humiliated when she failed to notice the change, until at last I called her attention to it. She then shrugged it off, leaving me confused. It had taken such courage to do. Children watch and listen to their parents, sometimes critically, but sometimes unquestioningly. Each of my parents influenced us in large ways and small. Certain of their habits rubbed off and left their mark. One very peculiar habit I picked up unconsciously from my mother was a tendency to be suspicious and tight and ungenerous about small things. Though she was very lavish in some ways, she would complain about small bills she received, certain that people were cheating her. She would buy a fur and say, "You have to be careful, because you can choose one and they'll substitute another." She said, "If you have your pearl necklace restrung, you have to sit and watch to be sure you get your own pearls back." She was mean about raises for people in the house. She literally hated to give things away, even praise or encouragement. I too developed an inability to spend money, along with a dark suspicion that people were taking advantage of me, and an inability to enjoy giving. Many of these habits were overcome when I married Phil Graham, who was exceedingly generous and imaginatively giving. Some habits I have never overcome are odd ones I inherited from my father. Despite the vast scale on which we lived, my father had peculiar fixations on certain small expenses. He preached tiny economies with zeal, using things up completely, never wasting, never phoning if you could wire, or better still, write. The compulsion I am still left with is turning out every light before I go to bed at night. To this day, alone in a house, I am totally unable to leave a light on. I will go up and down halls and staircases if I know a light is on. I tell myself to stop, that it doesn't matter, yet then I go and turn it off. Some lessons were impressed on me by reverse example. When I was young, I perceived grown-ups behaving quite oddly at times. I remember being shocked or dismayed by things I observed and making silent vows not to behave as they did when I grew up. For instance, my mother, when confronted with a line waiting at the movies, would go up to the box office and say, "I am Mrs. Eugene Meyer of the Washington Post," and demand to be taken in and seated. At that time, she did indeed get in. I cringed with embarrassment and hoped the ground would swallow me up. It had such a lasting effect on me that I have never been able to deal with head waiters in restaurants who put you in Siberia rather than the better part of the restaurant. I just go meekly to Siberia. As the years went on, my mother seemed to have a more and more difficult time emotionally. She became increasingly engrossed in her friendships with the series of men in her life, only one of which I believe may have been a true affair, the one with Bill Ward. She was constantly beset with colds, pneumonia, or various other illnesses, and she reacted to each one with the greatest amount of care, self-pity, and drama, demanding and receiving constant visits, with all of us dancing attendance. In retrospect, I wonder if depression contributed to this intense concentration on her health. She also started to drink more heavily, sometimes starting as early as 10 in the morning, at least during one period in her life. This was a problem that greatly worried my father and was an escalating burden to him and to all of us. Even her drinking was done in a somewhat eccentric way. There was an old-fashioned locked whiskey and wine closet in the basement to which only my father had the key. So he would have to make repeated trips to the cellar and therefore knew exactly how much she was drinking. Of course, admonishments on this score never had an effect. The surprising thing is that she never bought whiskey herself or asked him for her own key. My mother's effect on us was often contradictory. We received every encouragement for what we accomplished, yet her ego was such that she trampled on our incipient interests or enthusiasms. If I said I loved the Three Musketeers, she responded by saying I couldn't really appreciate it unless I had read it in French, as she had. Mother herself read constantly until the week she died, philosophy, history, biography, and all the English, American, French, German, and Russian classics. She had only scorn for people who read light novels, let alone trash or time wasters. The summer between fourth and fifth grades, I spent almost entirely by myself reading in a room on the third floor of Mount Kisco, where I went through all of Dumas, 8 volumes of Louisa May Alcott, starting with Little Women, Treasure Island, and a stirring adventure series by a man named Knipe. I counted up at the end, found that I had read around 100 books, and wrote my parents that I was positively floating in books. I couldn't have been happier. Unfortunately, this early passion for reading somehow diminished after the fifth grade, until I read only sporadically. A little later on, I was concentrating on movie magazines, Red Book and Cosmopolitan. Later still, I resumed reading, particularly loving Dickens's Great Expectations and Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Mother set impossibly high standards for us, creating tremendous pressures and undermining our ability to accomplish whatever modest aims we may have set for ourselves. Fundamentally, I think we all felt we somehow hadn't lived up to what she expected or wanted of us, and the insecurities and lack of self-confidence she bred were long-lasting. But despite whatever personal doubts about us she may have had, the picture of her family she presented to the world was unblemished. She created and then perpetuated the myth of her children's perfection. From her point of view, we were all happy, bilingual overachievers. Indeed, on some levels, she was proud of us. She used to compare us to the characters in a then-popular novel called The Constant Nymph, about an eccentric, boisterous, and madly funny family known as the Sanger Circus. Other myths she propagated about us were that Meyer girls were brighter, more attractive, funnier, smarter, more successful, this or that. In short, better than anyone else. Most important, she felt we should be different, more intellectual, eccentric even. In addition, there were expectations of us for social success, also difficult to define and deal with. Popularity at school or parties was thought to be a necessity for Meyer girls. I always said I had a wonderful time at a party, whether I did or not, and quite often I didn't. If one of my parents came to school or college, I thought I had to assemble a group of friends so that I could at least give the appearance of being in an acceptable swim. When we were very young, the McLeans, who then owned the Washington Post, gave children's parties at which expensive favors, even watches, were given to their guests. Mother told me in what poor taste this was and that she wouldn't let my sisters go. A friend of hers suggested that perhaps it was important to be seen there, to which my mother responded, "I want my children to be the ones to want to be with." Her predisposition to think this way also meant that she condescended to the average, to the pedestrian, to the everyday. This negative view of the commonplace became very much a part of me in my confusion. I knew that I wasn't any of the things that were held out as desirable. I also knew that I wanted to fit into the world, to be liked by people around me. Yet I adopted a lot of the family's philosophy, as did my older sisters and brother. I remember in college saying to my friend Mary Gentry, as we crossed the Vassar campus, "Do you like the girls here?" "Yes," she said, bringing me up short to the possibility that my criteria were suspect. I thought I should be condescending toward nice, normal people, and only like the brilliant eccentrics. It took me a long time to stop thinking that I had to be different, and that there was something wrong with being normal or average, and to get to the point of enjoying a variety of people for what they were. I can't say I think Mother genuinely loved us. Toward the end of her life, I was a success in her eyes, and perhaps that is what she loved. Yet, with all her complexity, I felt closer throughout my early childhood to my mother than to the very distant and rather difficult figure of my father. I liked him, but always from a distance. Actually, he delighted in children and was rather jolly with us, but a little awkward. At most, he would take one of us as a small child onto his lap and dangle a watch at our ear. When Ruth and I were very young, he would come into our bedroom before breakfast for a short period of roughhouse play. But though he lacked the gift of intimacy, in many ways his supportive love still came through to me. He somehow conveyed his belief in me without ever articulating it, and that was the single most sustaining thing in my life. That was what saved me. I realized this only in retrospect, however, since our relationship took time to grow. Sensitive subjects were rarely mentioned at our house, but three were particularly taboo: money, my father's being Jewish, and sex. None of the three was ever articulated by any of us in the family. In fact, nothing difficult or personal was discussed among us. There was such an aversion to talking about money or our wealth that, ironically, there was in some odd ways a fairly Spartan quality to our lives. We were not showered with conspicuous possessions, elaborate toys, or clothes. At one point, when Florence was 11, my mother wrote in her diary that she had gotten Flo very modest presents for her birthday: books, pralines, and other simple things. Though mother felt that she had been a bit mean, she also felt that it is the best way to continue their chance for happiness to restrain the desire for possessions. I had less than most of the girls in my class, certainly fewer clothes. My spare wardrobe in grammar school consisted of one or two jumpers and blouses for school and one best dress. We were also treated strictly in the matter of allowance. I still remember a telegram Biss sent my father from Vassar: "Allowance early or bust?" He wired back, "Bust." The only discussions I do remember relating to wealth had to do with being told that you couldn't just be a rich kid, that you had to do something, to be engaged in useful, productive work. You couldn't and shouldn't do nothing. Working was always a part of my life. I remember one Christmas vacation, when I was probably about 15, spent at the Federal Reserve Board learning to draw graphs. My mother's ambivalence about money and what it brought to her no doubt contributed to her own unwillingness to talk about it. Once, in 1922, after a visit to a Utah copper mine that had yielded my father great financial gains, she wrote in her diary, "The mine was an interesting sight, but the village that led up to it appalled me. This is where the money comes from, and I spend it on Chinese art. But it was a shock to think that we live on money that is produced under such conditions." Remarkably, the fact that we were half-Jewish was never mentioned any more than money was discussed. I was totally, incredibly, unaware of anti-Semitism, let alone of my father's being Jewish. I don't think this was deliberate. I am sure my parents were not denying or hiding my father's Jewishness from us, nor were they ashamed of it. But there was enough sensitivity so that it was never explained or taken pride in. Indeed, we had a pew in St. John's Episcopal Church, the President's Church on Lafayette Square, but mainly because the rector was a friend of the family. When I was about 10, all of us Meyer children were baptized at home to satisfy my devout Lutheran maternal grandmother, who thought that without such a precaution, we were all headed for hell. But for the most part, religion was not part of our lives. One of the few memories I have of any reference to my being Jewish is of an incident that took place when I was 10 or 11. At school, we were casting for reading aloud The Merchant of Venice, and one classmate suggested I should be Shylock because I was Jewish. In the same way, I had once innocently asked my mother whether we were millionaires, after someone at school accused my father of being one. I asked if I was Jewish and what that meant. She must have avoided the subject, because I don't remember the answer. This confusion about religion was not limited to me. My sister Biss recalls that at lunch in our apartment in New York once, with guests present, she blurted out, "Say, who is this guy Jesus everyone is talking about?" My identity as Jewish did not become an issue until I reached college, and a discussion arose with a girl from Chicago who was leaving Vassar. She had been asked if she would see another acquaintance, a Jewish girl, also from Chicago. "Oh, no," she replied, "you can't have a Jew in your house in Chicago." My best friend, Connie Dimmock, later told me how horrified she was to have this said in front of me. Only then did I get it, and this was 1935, with Hitler already a factor in the world. About the third thing that was never discussed in our family, sex, I knew nothing for a surprisingly long time. I had no idea what sex was or how babies were conceived. In fact, it was as if our rigorous schedules and exercise and athletic program were constructed to keep us from thinking too much about it. I once asked my mother what really happened during sex, telling her I'd read about the sperm and the ova, but wondered how it all worked. She responded, "Haven't you seen dogs in the street?" Although, unfortunately, I hadn't, I naturally said, "Of course." And that was the end of the conversation. Mother finally brought herself to speak to me about having periods or becoming a woman. "Don't worry about it, Mother," I replied. "It happened months ago." Because these matters were never discussed, I was almost totally unaware of all of them, money, religion, and sex. It's peculiar. I realized, of course, that the houses were big and that we had a lot of servants, but I didn't know we were rich any more than I knew we were Jewish. In some ways, it was quite bizarre, in others, quite healthy. Equally odd was how little we were taught about the practical aspects of life. I didn't know how to manage the simplest tasks. I didn't know how to dress, sew, cook, shop, and, rather more important, relate to people of any kind, let alone young men. My governess and I did some minor shopping, but as I grew up, I mostly inherited party dresses from my sisters, until when I was 18, Mother took me to Bergdorf Goodman for French clothes of staggering beauty and sophistication, which were well beyond my years, and whose quality was wasted on young people who dressed appropriately. There was nothing in between for every day. I was always well fed and cared for, of course. In fact, my mother was constantly reminding us of how lucky we were, how much we owed our parents, how far-seeing and wonderful my father was to have taken care of us all. And we were indeed lucky. We had vast privileges. We had parents with solid values. Our interests were aroused in art and politics and books. But to all of this, I brought my own feelings of inability and inferiority, not only to my mother, but to my older sisters and brother. I was, I thought, realistic about my own assets and abilities as I grew older. I was not very pretty. I grew tall early, and therefore seemed ungainly to myself. I didn't think I could excel, and was sure I'd never attract a man whom I would like and who would not be viewed with condescension by my parents and siblings. In all the turmoil of the family and our strange isolation both from our parents and from the outside world, we children were left to bring ourselves up emotionally and intellectually. We were leading lives fraught with ambivalence. It was hard to have an identity. An early example of this came one day when the telephone rang in the playroom and there was no grown-up present. Biss very fearfully picked up the phone and said hello. A male voice impatiently asked, "Who is this? Who is this?" To which Biss replied, "This is the little girl that Mademoiselle takes care of." That was the only way she could think of to describe herself to a strange grown-up. So the question of who we really were and what our aspirations were, intellectual or social, was always disquieting. The more subtle inheritance of my strange childhood was the feeling, which we all shared to some extent, of believing we were never quite going about things correctly. Had I said the right thing? Had I worn the right clothes? Was I attractive? These questions were unsettling and self-absorbing, even overwhelming at times, and remained so throughout much of my adult life, until at last I grew impatient with dwelling on the past. Chapter 3. In June of 1933, my father bought the Washington Post. None of us could have known then what a transforming event this would be in all our lives. The paper had fallen on hard times, brought on in large part by the aimless ways of its owner, Edward Beale MacLean, a dapper playboy whom Alice Longworth later described as a pathetic man with no chin and no character. Ned, as he was known, had been a poker and golf companion of President Harding, though their relationship ended badly for Ned when he, along with the paper, was linked to the Teapot Dome scandal. From the time he inherited the Post in 1916 until he lost it a decade and a half later, Ned had paid scant attention to either its news or its business side. He brought his mistress to editorial meetings, or so it was alleged by his wife Evelyn, in divorce proceedings. In fact, concerning his news sense, Evelyn memorably said, "He would not have recognized a piece of news, not even if the man who bit the dog likewise bit Ned MacLean." Evelyn, for her part, operated on a grand scale. The wealthy daughter of a mining tycoon, she lived in huge houses, gave lavish parties, and owned and wore the famous Hope Diamond, which was reputed to bring bad luck to its owners, and seems to have done so for her. She had every intention of saving the Post for her sons, and so had turned down several offers to buy it, or urged her husband to do so, including at least one from my father. In fact, my father had several times before expressed interest in the Post and other papers. As early as 1925, when he realized that Hearst had two papers in Washington, both losers, he thought Hearst might be willing to sell one and tried to acquire the Morning Washington Herald. 4 years later, in 1929, he tried to buy the Post for $5 million, certain that this price was so high that the American Security Trust Company, which controlled the paper then, couldn't possibly afford to turn him down. But it did. Other offers for the Post, including two in 1931, each for $3 million, were also rejected. This was because Evelyn MacLean held on, despite divorce proceedings and court fights. So the profitable paper Ned had inherited from his father continued its downhill slide. Poorly managed, with at least $500,000 in debts, it was forced into receivership in March 1932, unable even to pay its newsprint bills, and was to be sold at public auction. Meanwhile, in September 1930, my father had been appointed by Hoover to be governor of the Federal Reserve Board. What he undertook in this job was nothing less than an attempt to turn around the Depression. He guided the banking and monetary policies of the United States, domestically and abroad. He conceptualized the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, writing the legislation to set it up, shepherding the bill through the Congress, and serving as chairman of the new credit agency. His name was specifically written into the legislation as chairman so that the bill would be sure to pass, as well as keeping his responsibilities as governor of the Federal Reserve. But the strain of running one institution in the morning and another in the afternoon, and both during the worst of the Depression, was too great, and he nearly broke under the pressure. My mother went to see President Hoover to say that these intolerable professional burdens could not continue, and that the president would have to relieve my father of some of his duties before he had a complete breakdown. In her diary, she gave a graphic description of her visit to the president. "Yesterday was Eugene's low water mark in physical fatigue. He was so much harassed by White House pounding that I made a secret appointment with Hoover and frightened him thoroughly by telling him E would break physically unless he, H, helped protect him from senatorial greed. The plan worked, and I am sure H will move carefully from now on in his whole attitude toward E. Without accusing H of anything, I forced him at least temporarily into the position of ally, which he never can be permanently because of his unfortunate disposition, which sacrifices everybody and everything to what momentarily seems advantageous to his own position and objectives. During my conversation with the Prez, I was surprised after hearing only E's version of their ever-stormy relationship to have him begin by saying emphatically, 'Eugene Meyer is the most valuable man I've got. My chief occupation is to keep E well.' In the end, what helped relieve the pressure a little was congressional passage of the Emergency Relief and Construction Act of 1932, which separated the two jobs of the Federal Reserve and the RFC, and allowed my father to give up the latter. The election of Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1932, of course, created a different problem for my father, a Hoover appointee. He felt that what he had attempted was for the public good, so he saw no point in resigning, even though Hoover wanted him to. My mother's interpretation of Hoover's repeatedly urging my father to resign before Roosevelt's inauguration was typically to the point. "Perhaps like an Oriental widow, he is expected to hurl himself upon his master's funeral pyre. I think H., Hoover, would like to go down to his political grave with all his retainers, household, and even the pet dogs buried with him like the Iranian or Scythian chiefs." My father may have felt similarly, but he had no intention of making his job as governor of the Federal Reserve look like a political position, which he felt it was not meant to be nor should be. On the other hand, he didn't see any sense in remaining in the government, since he felt he was tilting at windmills. When Roosevelt asked him to stay as head of the Federal Reserve, he agreed to do so, but in late March he sent FDR his letter of resignation. In his eyes, Roosevelt's sins were many, but a few stood out. His experimentation with the dollar, his disregard for the gold standard, and his general lack of sophistication about economic and financial policies, a lack shared, I must say, by every other president. So, the bankruptcy of the post came at a propitious time for my father, just as he was leaving the government. He and my mother had clearly discussed the possibility of buying the paper, since she wrote in her diary on May 7th, nearly a month before the purchase, and the day before my father's resignation from the Federal Reserve Board was accepted by FDR. "He, Eugene, has suddenly decided to buy TP. If he succeeds, it will be a sensation, and we shall have a reputation for Machiavellian behavior. I was reluctant at first, because it means more hard work at once, but after all, these are not times in which to loiter. Also, it means a heavy expenditure, but what, after all, is money for, if not to be used?" Yet, sometime after this diary entry, my father had still not decided to make the purchase. Instead, the first thing he did was retire to Mount Kisco. The story goes that after his second week of retirement, he came down the stairs, trailing his finger on the banister and claiming to find dust. He murmured something about the houses not being properly run, To which my mother responded, "Eugene, it's time you bought the Post." He himself explained what happened to a group from the American Society of Newspaper Editors in 1934. "Like the Oriental philosophers of olden days, I was determined to leave a chaotic world in order to enjoy the peace and seclusion of an agricultural existence. This benign mood lasted just 2 weeks when I decided, and I am afraid my family also decided, that the contemplative life was not for me." Ironically, he was prompted to reconsider the Post by a visit to Mount Kisco from Sissy Patterson, Eleanor Medill Patterson, who had been a longtime friend of both my parents. Sissy was the sister of Joe Patterson, founder of the New York Daily News, at that time the great tabloid, and a cousin of Colonel Robert McCormick, owner and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. The McCormick women were strong and intelligent, and Sissy was all of that. She was what the French call a jolie laide, a woman who is feature for feature ugly, but succeeds in being beautiful. She lived in a mansion on DuPont Circle, now the Washington Club, became the editor of Hearst's Morning Herald, and later was also editor and publisher of the afternoon Washington Times, leasing the papers from Hearst until she finally bought them and combined them into one all-day paper. At this point, in 1933, she knew one important thing, that her future depended on who owned the Washington Post. Aware of my father's previous attempts to buy Washington newspapers, she came to ask if he meant to buy the Post now, and her question actually rearoused his interest. This time, it held, and he came down to Washington to pursue the paper. Since it was known that he had at one time been willing to pay $5 million for it, he didn't want to escalate the bidding at the auction by revealing his identity. Consequently, he had a lawyer, George E. Hamilton, Jr., do the bidding for him, and instructed Hamilton to raise anybody's bid by $50,000 or even $100,000 immediately, as though he were going to go on forever, then to jump in increments of $25,000 once the bidding reached $800,000. He also gave Hamilton an outside parameter of $1.5 to $1.7 million and sent him off to the auction on his behalf. He himself remained out of sight at Crescent Place, which was essentially closed up for the summer, hiding with his friend and lifelong assistant, Floyd Harrison. The auction was held on the steps of the Post's gray gingerbread building at E Street on Pennsylvania Avenue on June 1, 1933, just a few weeks after my father had ostensibly retired. Gathered there on the steps of the building that day, among others, were Ned McLean's estranged wife, Evelyn, dressed in black and wearing the Hope diamond, her two sons, her friend Alice Longworth, David Bruce, then Andrew Mellon's son-in-law, the Washington Star's president, Victor Kaufman, and its business manager, Fleming Newbold, and representatives for the McLeans, Hearst, and other bidders. All that was being sold at auction was what was left of the fifth of five newspapers in town, a circulation reduced to 50,000, the quaint, run-down old building, and an AP franchise. In short, a decrepit paper with debts of $600,000. Mrs. McLean's attorney and Hearst's lawyers, urged on by Sissy, were the only bidders who stayed with Hamilton's bids initially, but Mrs. McLean dropped out of the bidding at $600,000. Hearst's people kept pace with Hamilton's bids until the price reached $800,000. Hamilton, as instructed, went to $825,000. Hearst must have instructed his bidders to stop at $800,000 because they then dropped out. Sissy Patterson begged the auctioneer to delay the award so that she could telephone Hearst for his authority to go higher. She received three delays, but then Hamilton threatened to withdraw his bid. Hearst, who was no doubt cash poor in 1933, finally refused to go on. The gavel came down to Hamilton, acting on behalf of an anonymous bidder. My father had bought the Washington Post, for which he had 5 years earlier offered $5 million, for $825,000. What is most amazing to me about the purchase of the Post, especially given its importance to my future life and that of my family, is that I knew nothing about it. No one in my family had mentioned it to me, either before or even immediately after, nor were they aware they hadn't told me about it. At the time of the auction, I had just finished my junior year at Madeira and was still there, preparing to take college boards. Nancy White roomed next door to me. She was the daughter of Tom White, the general manager of all of Hearst's enterprises, his right-hand man, in effect, and also a close friend, some said lover, of Cissy Patterson. Nancy and I, naturally curious because of her father's interests in journalism and my father's years of public service, discussed the auction and speculated on the anonymous purchaser of the paper. When I finished my college boards, I went home to Mount Kisco, where the family had already settled for the summer. As we were sitting on the porch, my mother mentioned something to my father about when you take over the post, and so remote in my mind was the possibility that he might have been the anonymous buyer that I asked in all innocence what she was talking about. "Oh, darling," she said, "didn't anyone tell you? Dad has bought the post." "No," I said, "as a matter of fact, no one did." Shortly after I discovered the secret purchase, it was announced publicly. The delay between the purchase date and the date of revelation of its new owner was necessary so that the courts could approve the sale. My father had agreed to a 10-day delay by the court, at the end of which Charles Evans Hughes, then a lawyer for Evelyn McLean, sought to reopen the bidding. When the receiver reported that the anonymous bidder was ready to pay cash, the court finalized the sale to my father, which was announced in a box on the front page of the Post on June 13, 1933. The first time I was ever in the Washington Post's building was a day or two after that, when my brother Bill and I traveled from Mount Kisco to Washington with my father and were taken on a tour through the building at night by what must have been some very nervous individuals. There was a skeleton staff that had remained through the difficult last days of the McLean era, a few fine people who had kept the paper going, and some others who had nowhere else to go. Much of the reaction, at least what appeared in print, to the announcement of the new owner, was favorable. Privately, however, there were doubts, which lingered on for years, both about the possibility of the Post's being a nonpartisan paper, and about whether the number 5 paper in town, run by an inexperienced publisher, would ever make it. On the latter point, Gardner Cowles, one of the most able independent publishers in the country, warned my father that Washington was an afternoon newspaper town, with the government workers getting to their jobs early and home by 4:30. He said no morning paper, especially the Post, would ever amount to anything. The Star had the town by the throat. To Cowles, my father rather piously responded, "The capital of this great nation deserves a good paper. I believe in the American people. They can be relied on to do the right thing when they know the facts. I am going to give them the unbiased truth. When an idea is right, nothing can stop it." As to whether the paper would or could be nonpartisan with a Republican owner like Eugene Meyer, my father emphasized from the start that the Post would be independent. Even in the announcement about his ownership, there were several key statements that proved to be the underpinnings of Eugene Meyer's Post. It was his aim to improve the paper, and he would do so by making it an independent voice. He explained that in purchasing the Post, he had acted in his own behalf and without persuasion from any person, group, or organization. Although many people did not quite believe this at the time, it was true, and he was trying to assure the public that the Post would not be a toy, it would not be the voice of the Republican Party, and it would not be used to fight Franklin Roosevelt, although it later did, to some extent. From the beginning, my father was excited. The challenge seemed to have rejuvenated him. Morale at the paper improved immediately after he reversed the 10% pay cut that had been imposed by the receivers and told the employees they could all keep their jobs if they just made good. Then he looked around and very quickly began to face the stark reality of the wreck he had acquired, a paper with a reduced number of pages that had lost most of its good people, a paper with drastically diminished circulation and advertising, and one that had been operating without knowing whether the presses would run the next day. On the very day he was announced as the owner, the paper was only 18 pages, with a total of 19 columns of display ads and less than 2 pages of classified ads. As my father said, it was a paper that was mentally, morally, physically, and in every other way, bankrupt. At the outset, in attempting to reorganize the paper, he had rather naively felt that since he had been a success at business and government, he could apply what he had learned to the realm of journalism. Though he didn't understand newspapers, he thought he could turn this one around simply by investing heavily and running it better. Instead, there followed years of struggle and discouragement and investment with only minimal success. He learned some expensive lessons. The going-in price was just the beginning of the financial drain and mental strain that went on for most of the next 20 years, and there were many moments during these years of uphill battle when he had his doubts about whether he could ever succeed. He would moan to us and even talk about selling it, although never, I think, seriously. One of those moments, and one of his roughest experiences, came almost at once. His erstwhile friend, Sissy Patterson, having been disappointed at losing her golden opportunity, now taught him a lesson in cutthroat competition, which led to a spectacular brawl between the two of them. Sissy swiped the Post's comics by getting her cousin Bertie McCormick to switch them to her. McCormick not only ran the Chicago Tribune, but owned one of the most powerful syndicates that sold features to newspapers nationwide, and Sissy herself was a shareholder in his Tribune. She had the syndicate inform my father that the sale of the Post voided the contract for four of the most popular comics, Andy Gump, Dick Tracy, Gasoline Alley, and Winnie Winkle. The comics would go to the Herald, and Sissy proudly advertised the shift. My father had never read comics and asked the Post's business manager, A.D. Marks, whether they were important. Marks was deeply shocked at this amateur's lack of understanding about what attracted circulation. Comics were all important to circulation, then even more than now, and indeed were the best and most important asset the paper had, he assured the new owner, who promptly sued Sissy. Sissy then phoned him, saying that her brother Joe Patterson had created these comics and that her relationship to McCormick and Patterson somehow gave her the right to them. When my father pointed out that he now owned the rights in Washington, she responded, "This means a fight." And it did. For 2 years, the legal battle of the funny pages was waged, ending the long, close friendship between Sissy and my parents. My father first won a temporary restraining order in New York that prohibited the Herald from publishing the comics, but this order was later dissolved, and for a while both papers were printing them. Then she won, and the Post filed against the syndicate that distributed the comics, winning the case against the Chicago Tribune in New York in July of 1934, when a judge ruled that the Post was the legal owner of the rights. The case against the Herald was heard in Washington, where the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia came to the same conclusion in March 1935. Sissy took the case to the Supreme Court, which refused to hear it. On April 10, 1935, victory was his. When the final decree came down forbidding Sissy to print the comics in the Herald, she asked my father's permission to print the ones scheduled for the following Sunday, since the color comics were printed in advance and she already had them. So intense had the bitterness grown that my father gave his approval on the condition that she give the Post credit and note that henceforth the comics would appear only in the Post. Not only did Sissy refuse, naturally, but not long after, in retaliation, she sent my father an ornately wrapped florist's box, inside which orchids surrounded a smaller package that contained a piece of raw meat. Sissy had written a card to drive home the point about the pound of flesh, so as not to disappoint you. This unpleasantly loaded reference to Shylock shows how brutal the fight had become. From then on, she kept goading him and the Post in every possible way. If the Post made a mistake, she exploited it. Finally, my father called her and said, "Sissy, if you don't stop lying about me, I'm going to start telling the truth about you." 22 months after the end of the lawsuit, she got the comics anyway, when the contract for the Post finally expired. She and my father didn't speak again for years, except once when they were both asked to dinner by Mrs. Sumner Wells, the wife of the Undersecretary of State, a lady unconscious of strains in relationships. My friend Louvie Pearson, who was there, later told me that they sat down together and talked most of the night. All the while the intense fight over the comics was going on, My father was hard at work trying to improve the paper and to make it financially solvent. He soon realized that the newspaper business was like no other business he knew. You couldn't use ordinary techniques for improving a business and then look for results. He had very little idea of what could be done to make the paper a financial success, particularly since there were so many papers in Washington. What he did have was a well-developed philosophy, which he spelled out in an early editorial in 1934 and in several speeches over the next few years. He felt a newspaper was a public trust, meant to serve the public in a democracy. My father wanted a paper that would advance beyond what it had achieved, even in its heyday, and take a leadership which could be achieved only by exceptional quality. In one address, on March 5, 1935, he spoke about the principles that he insisted on from the beginning, outlining them as follows. 1. That the first mission of a newspaper is to tell the truth as nearly as the truth may be ascertained. 2. That the newspaper shall tell all the truth, so far as it can learn it, concerning the important affairs of America and the world. 3. That as a disseminator of news, the paper shall observe the decencies that are obligatory upon a private gentleman. 4. That what it prints shall be fit reading for the young as well as for the old. 5. That the newspaper's duty is to its readers and to the public at large, and not to the private interests of its owner. 6. That in the pursuit of truth, the newspaper shall be prepared to make sacrifice of its material fortunes, if such course be necessary for the public good. 7. That the newspaper shall not be the ally of any special interest, but shall be fair and free and wholesome in its outlook on public affairs and public men. These principles were the heart and soul of his convictions, but how to translate them into action was the challenge. The first thing he worked on was the people needed to undertake the daunting task of turning the paper around. To begin with, he didn't know who the good people were or how to find them. When he did find good people, some newsmen he'd heard about or others he had scouted out, it was almost impossible to persuade them to come to work for what looked like a failing newspaper. In addition, the professionals continued to be unsure about my father's motives. His statements to the contrary, many went on believing that he was there to run a Republican paper, or at least use the post to set right the Roosevelt administration. My father always claimed that the competing papers in Washington kept circulating rumors that added to the uncertainty and difficulty of acquiring a first-class staff. The search was on for staff people for the editorial and news side of the paper, as well as for the business side. People of uneven quality were hired, others were brought in for advice or appraisal. Management problems at the Post vexed him from the beginning. As general manager to oversee everything except the editorial page, he hired Eugene McLean from the San Francisco News, who lasted about 2 years. He recognized that although McLean was a superior reporter, he did nothing to build up good people in the organization. He saw him as lazy, a drunkard, and a womanizer. I myself was quite surprised during one of McLean's visits to Mount Kisco when, during the course of an earnest conversation about newspapers, he suddenly grabbed me, a 17-year-old, and kissed me. I told nobody about this. My father knew nothing about advertising, but after one false start, he hired a first-class business executive, Don Bernard, whom he had found at the Knoxville Banner and who eventually helped him bring order to the chaotic business side. Editorially, too, the dark preceded the dawn, for my father soon found Alexander F. Jones, Casey as he was known, who appeared on the scene in November 1935 as the Post's new managing editor. Casey was just what the Post needed. He came from the blood-and-guts school of journalism and was a fine, solid, slam-bang, hard-news, straight-ahead editor, perfect for a transition period. He brought substantial professionalism and journalistic standards to the job, as well as technical knowledge and expertise in newspaper management and production. Together, Casey Jones and my father went on a hiring spree, in some cases paying high salaries out of line with the times, and brought on many people who became important to the future of the paper. Recognizing the significance of a paper in the nation's capital, they began to assemble a separate staff of national news writers to give full coverage to government news, particularly the affairs of the federal government. From the beginning, my father also had seen the importance of the local aspect of the paper, particularly in light of the strange way in which the city was governed. In sports, my father had the benefit of a holdover from the old McLean regime, Shirley Povich, a brilliant sports writer and editor hired in 1921 by Ned McLean, for whom he had once caddied in Maine. After a sensational career of more than 70 years, Povich still goes into the office frequently and occasionally writes for the paper. Povich later told the story of another area, like the comics, about which my father was an innocent. In 1934, when the Senators, the local baseball team, were finishing a disastrous seventh in the American League, my father, thinking the team was supposed to win the pennant every year, as they had in 1933, asked him what was wrong with the ball club. "Pitching, no pitching, Mr. Meyer," Povich told him. "Tell me, maybe it would be good for the Washington Post. How much does it cost to buy a pitcher?" my father innocently inquired. He had already grown to realize the importance of sports to newspaper readership. In those days, the people in Washington often found out what was happening at the ballpark by watching the big scoreboard in front of the Post's E Street building, where the scores were posted in chalk. Occasionally, my father himself carried the scores from the telegraph man to the man at the scoreboard. Once, when Goose Goslin hit a home run to win a big game, he asked that the scores not be posted until he could get there and see the pleasure of the large crowds that always gathered to watch. Understanding the limits of syndicated material and the extent to which it caused newspapers to lose their individual character, my father was determined that the Post attempt to be as original as it could. One area he focused on was the women's pages, building them up under a highly intelligent editor, Malvina Lindsay, who also wrote a column, The Gentler Sex. He thought the Post's material for women was dreary and began to create a staff of writers, as he said, who would write for Washington women, among Washington women, and about the interests of Washington women. Even within a year of his purchase of the paper, he considered this revitalization of the women's pages to be one of the Post's most successful accomplishments. Unusually for the Times, he hired women for those pages and gave them prominent roles on the paper. His interest in psychiatry and mental health led him to look for a psychiatrist to write an advice column for people with problems. When he couldn't lure a psychiatrist to the task, he selected Elizabeth Young, a staff reporter on the women's pages, to write it, and had her work overseen by a psychiatrist for the first few months. Young, who wrote under the name Mary Hayworth, was so capable that her column became one of the most popular features on the paper, receiving more than 20,000 letters a year seeking advice. It's hard to convey how groundbreaking and successful this column was, but it was eventually syndicated and read by 20 million people. Another successful initiative of his was introducing the publication of reader opinion polls. Dr. George Gallup was just starting his American Institute of Public Opinion, and his polls weren't taken very seriously. Ever the logical thinker, and having always put a premium on the importance of research, my father signed the first contract with Gallup and ran his polls on the front page. Most important, what he worked on from the very start of his ownership was developing the editorial page. He believed that the editorial page as a force in American life had dwindled in power and prestige, and felt that a rejuvenated page on the Post would make the paper, that a good editorial page was more important in the nation's capital than anywhere else in the country. He tried always to instill in the editors the importance of avoiding emotional, vindictive, or partisan voices, and he vowed never to subscribe blindly to a government policy simply because it was a government policy, not to submit to domination by officialdom, and to avoid the subtle influence of mob psychology. He had his own philosophy in place, but the challenge was to find a really distinguished editorial page editor, one who shared his ideals and his aspirations. After making several efforts to hire high-profile writers from other papers, he began to look for a vigorous, unlabeled young man, and settled on Felix Morley, who arrived at the post in December 1933. Morley had been a Rhodes Scholar and a research fellow at the London School of Economics. He had also been an editorial writer and a foreign correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, and was the author of a book on the League of Nations. The brother of novelist Christopher Morley, Felix was very bright, literate, and a Quaker. Again, my father started a tradition, carried on to this day by the publisher of the Post, by making an arrangement with Morley that he would never be asked to write something with which he disagreed. The two men agreed that in case of a showdown, the publisher reserved the right to have his view prevail, and their relationship evolved into a collegial one and remained so until their strong disagreements prior to America's entry into World War II, when Morley's pacifist views made him more of an isolationist. The important thing was the establishment of an independent voice on the paper, which was its first distinguishing characteristic. Morley quickly began to make his mark on the page and on the paper. A Fortune article from 1944 that took a retrospective look at the Post said that, with his arrival, the Post's editorial page at once began to acquire insight, vigor, and prestige. Morley himself started another tradition that has prevailed, that of editorialists doing some of their own reporting, as well as talking to the reporters who were working on stories and to outside sources, carefully researching both sides of an issue before forming an opinion. As he and Casey had done for News, my father and Morley began to build an outstanding editorial staff. They hired a brilliant economic and financial writer, Anna Youngman, who had been a professor at Wellesley and was on the research staff at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. She wore her gray hair clipped short like a man's and was a bundle of hard-headed, honest rectitude. Morley held on to an invaluable asset from the McLean regime in Merlo J. Pusey, who had arrived in 1928 and remained for 38 years. Until he retired, he was a sage, somewhat conservative and steadying influence on the paper, in the process winning the 1936 Pulitzer Prize, the Post's first, for editorial writing. Eventually, he was to write my father's biography. Even my mother tried her hand at editorials. She sent one to Morley in October 1935, saying, "If my first efforts are too inexperienced, pray put them aside until I can write things in such shape that you can use them without too many changes. The medium is new to me and makes me rather self-conscious." Not self-conscious enough not to attempt them, however. She also wrote provocative letters to the editor, one of which concluded, "Yours for more and better rouse in the letter column," and was signed Jonathan Swift. Post editorials began having an effect on Congress and the government, and although the paper often quarreled with the administration, it backed the government, my father claimed, on as many measures as it opposed it. The Post engaged in campaigns on various fronts, fighting against what my father saw as the inflationary policies of FDR, the NRA, Rexford Tugwell, and Henry Wallace, and fighting for SEC rules that would protect investors against fraud, cleaning up Washington's hidden slums, and coming out strongly for Roosevelt's quarantine speech in 1937. Despite my father's desire that the Post be independent and objective, someone remarked that the front page at first read like a Federal Reserve Board bulletin. It seems that many of the editors and reporters were aiming to please by giving him what they thought he wanted. Indeed, in the very earliest period of my father's publishership, the staff persisted in focusing on stories about finance, banking, and taxation. They soon discovered he was quite serious about the independence of the paper and the autonomy of its reporters and editors within the limits of his principles. He worked out a system that endured, one of delegating autonomy to his managers on both sides, editorial and business, provided they performed according to his standards and ambitions. Since three of the last five Post publishers, my father, Phil Graham, and myself, came to work inexperienced in different ways, this was the only practical way to run things anyway, but I still believe it's the best way for newspapers to be run editorially. In 1935 alone, my father lost more than $1.3 million. From that year on, he made the Post a partnership with my mother, with any profits and losses to be divided between the two partners, my father bearing 93% and my mother 7%. Despite the losses, which were now partially tax-deductible, real progress had been made, but the progress was more in news than in advertising and circulation. His quest for integrity clearly extended to the business side. He wanted to be sure the advertising salespeople would study the needs of advertisers and honestly try to fulfill them. The story of the Post's editorial transformation had to be sold to retail advertisers, and my father was deeply involved in that sales effort. But real circulation success continued to elude him until over a decade later, after the war. By 1935, my father had begun to understand what the newspaper business was all about. Gradually, an organization was put in place that worked well for its time. He installed a better typeface and improved graphics to make a more readable paper. He enlarged the E Street building by adding a wing and renting space in the Munsey building next door. He even reported some stories himself, or at least passed on stories to his reporters. It was he who provided the Post with its scoop that King Edward VIII planned to marry the divorced American Wallace Simpson. He took great pride in delivering any tip that turned into a big story, as did I many years later. Little by little, despite the fact that within the walls of the Post's building during the first few years, there seemed to be nothing but trouble, uphill struggle, a revolving door of people coming and going, some failing and some leaving for better jobs, and money hemorrhaging, the paper was making progress, so much so that Senator Arthur H. Vandenberg credited the Post with the most amazing improvement in the past 12 months of any newspaper ever to come to my attention. Prospective buyers turned up from time to time, from Andrew Mellon to Walter Winchell, all of whom my father flatly rejected, while on the other hand, his own attempt to buy the Washington Herald from Hearst in 1936 was foiled when Sissy Patterson heard of the negotiations and phoned Hearst, weeping until he submitted. Nothing was going to come easily. From my first visit to the paper in June of 1933, the Washington Post was constantly part of my life. My family owned it, cared deeply about it, and was immersed in the minutiae of its daily travails. My father, the paper's owner and publisher and president of the New Washington Post Company, became its best salesman, never missing an opportunity to sell an ad, offering subscriptions to cab drivers, calling the news desk frequently to ask what's new, stopping by nightly, often in his tuxedo after a late dinner, to check on things. My mother's level of enthusiasm and involvement was no less than his. Her bylines appeared frequently in the paper, particularly in the early years, and the extent of her caring was evident in a memo she sent my father complaining about the lack of Post boxes compared with a number for all the other Washington papers she had observed on one of her forays into the countryside. She stopped to interview people along the way to find out what the problem was and reported that the Washington Post has lost a vast amount of subscriptions because for a long time it had an unreliable carrier boy. The impression of the people living there is that this circulation could easily be regained by a little special attention and a good carrier boy. I worked for the Post as early as the summer of 1934, between high school and college. I was mainly a copy girl or messenger in the women's department, but I became friends with those two fine newswomen, Malvina Lindsay and Mary Hayworth. From then on, I had occasional summer jobs at the Post. When I went to college a year after the purchase, my parents and I corresponded constantly about what was happening. I read the Post daily, commented, encouraged, and even criticized, while my parents, particularly my father, told me in great detail about what was going on. I found myself deeply involved with the struggle to improve the paper. Somewhat to my surprise, given that I thought of myself during this period as unsophisticated, unworldly, and fairly unopinionated, I seem to have been full of independent appraisals of the paper and what it was printing. For instance, at the age of 17, I wrote my parents, "Have been reading the Post faithfully. I think it really is getting very good. The human interest that was jammed down its throat at first and looked so awkward seems to be getting underneath the news now. I find myself unconsciously picking it up for my New York paper. I think you slipped up once when you put the over-pathetic community chest advertisement depicting the children on the streets opposite the page showing society at a dance. It might have made people give, or it might have been unintentional, but the effect was rather startling, especially, I should think, to the unemployed. However, that is a minor detail. I should think you would be encouraged as a whole. Much later, the depth of my caring was pointed out to me by Phil's psychiatrist, who told me that Phil and I both had a problem. We cared too much about the Post. I told him, in one of the great understatements of my life, that I feared there was little he could do about that. Chapter 4. In the fall of 1934, I left for Vassar, which I had chosen by a process of non-thought. That is, next to no thinking went into my decision to go there. It simply was the in place at the time. Most Madeira seniors went there, as had Biss, whom I always wished to emulate. At the time I arrived on campus for my freshman year, Biss and Bill were in London living together in a small flat. Bill was taking his junior year abroad at the London School of Economics, where my parents had sent him out of discouragement with his Yale career. He had been on the diving team and was an accomplished athlete. However, he was on probation academically. In London, he was to study with my father's friend Harold Lasky, that brilliant, erratic, left-wing professor and intellectual. Biss had spent her junior year abroad in Munich, where she had cut her usual glamorous swath, studied some, gone on with her violin, and enjoyed life with at least one or two heavy bows in different countries. Instead of returning to Vassar, she had gone to work for Alexander Korda, the British movie producer, working with her friend the playwright Sam Berman on The Scarlet Pimpernel. Flo was dancing, with a Greek partner at least a foot shorter than she. One of her first appearances occurred at a party given by my mother at Crescent Place. Mother wrote me a characteristic letter in May of 1935 describing the event. "Wish you had been here for my big dinner. Madame Peter, wife of the Swiss ambassador, said it was the best party she had seen at Washington. Flo danced on a platform on the terrace because we recognized at last moment that drawing room was much too small. As it was drizzling, we had to toss huge awning over everything. Jules, the butler, went to hospital the day before with kidney stones, and Robert, the other butler, had just had his appendix out. But I just ignored difficulties, and we came through with the Meyer social colors flying higher than ever." While my older sisters and brother were thus venturing into the real world, I was so unworldly that it was difficult for me to function. My new circle of friends and range of activities all looked appropriate and right, but I found them confusing and felt lost. I had a particularly hard time concentrating on my work and reading. My mind constantly wandered to where I was going and what I was doing, to the problem of how not to be lonely. In addition, I was coping with difficulties stemming from my protected and waited-on background, which I had always taken for granted. Not being very conscious of fashion, I had only the few elegant made-to-order dresses chosen by my mother, and nothing for every day. Before college began, I had set forth to buy clothes, with no idea where to go or what I would need, and I somehow outfitted myself with skirts and sweaters. But I wore one yellow cardigan through the first weeks of school until Thanksgiving, when someone finally suggested it should be washed. I had noticed girls' sweaters stretched out on towels, but had no idea either that I should be following their example, or even how to. At home, someone had always removed dirty and discarded clothes, which later reappeared in my drawers. I resolved that problem by sending the yellow sweater out to a cleaner, and never did learn how to wash one. This ignorance of practical matters applied to every aspect of daily life, whether it was cooking or cleaning, or decorating or buying my clothes, or knowing how much I could spend or how much others spent. I had to learn from life, from bumping up against reality, or from my friends. Even so, I muddled through and learned a great deal my freshman year. In particular, I became aware of the issues surrounding the Roosevelt administration. The New Deal became a reality for the first time, and I began to be interested in it in a less than abstract way. The atmosphere at home was so anti-Roosevelt, Dad in a rational, measured way, Mother more emotionally, that I had never really heard a pro-New Deal position. Between the professors, the radical girls on the Vassar newspaper, which I went out for, and a new good friend, Connie Dimmock, who gradually turned extremely left-wing, I became converted to the goals of the New Deal. In fact, the three Middlemeyer children all became New Dealers, our views resulting in wild and vociferous political arguments with both parents, but mostly my mother. Perhaps because of my conservative temperament, I slowly developed ideas that have remained fairly consistent throughout my life, with variations now and then. I believed, and believe, that capitalism works best for a freedom-loving society, that it brings more prosperity to more people than any other social economic system,